a little bit of an increase to pay for the new
council. The hour of 10:15, having right, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Norris, could you please move the minutes of March 18th?
Chair Davids, I move the March 18th minutes.
Any additions or corrections? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Norris. And we do have a quorum, so we are officially in order. We have a great agenda today, members. The first item that we have is from the Department of Revenue. Mr. Ouellette, Director of Tax Research Division, will be presenting the tax incident study, and you have it right here. You should have a copy. If you don't, raise your hand and we'll get you one. So if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and start with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellette. I'm the Director of Tax Research at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I've been in this role for about 9 years now, and with the department for about 20. I'm here to present the 2026 version of Minnesota's tax incident study. Like a lot of researchers, I never met a chart I didn't like, so I probably got too many slides, and I apologize for that. I will move through them with a certain amount of pace. If there's anything I'm going too fast on, please flag me to slow down, and I can zoom in on whatever. What I'd like to do is just give you sort of a taste of what's in the study and put it in the context of studies that have gone in the past. It's a sort of study that you can refer to for a lot of different questions, and hopefully you will find some use for it. Okay, so I'll do a quick overview of what's in the study. I'll summarize the results. This particular study focuses on tax year 2023. That is the year we have the most current data for. We'll compare these results to what you've seen in previous studies if you've been around the committee for a while. And then we'll also look at law changes since 2023 that impact future taxes, and we'll project what the tax system is likely to look like in 2028. And I'll end with a quick comparison of how Minnesota compares to other states in terms of the incidence of taxes. So this study attempts to answer the question, who ultimately pays Minnesota's taxes? It's one of the more comprehensive tax incident studies that's done across the country. Some of our counterparts in other states have done tax incident studies. Very few do one on a regular basis like Minnesota does, and very few include as many taxes and as much income as our study does. So we've gotten a lot of accolades from around the country on this report, and we hope that you'll find some use in it. So what we do is we create a database with data about the year 2023 in this case. We're looking at all Minnesota taxes, not just state taxes, not just taxes paid by individuals, but all the taxes that are raised by state and local government. That does not mean all the taxes Minnesotans pay. Minnesotans also pay federal taxes. Those are not included in the results here. Minnesotans pay taxes to other states if they have income that's sourced to other states, or if they travel and they make purchases in other states. This is about the taxes that fund Minnesota state and local governments. So the next two slides are just a list of what taxes are included. You can find these on table 2.2 in the report. I need to say that the version of the PowerPoint that was posted online and that you have hard copies of, this slide and the next slide had some errors in them. So what I'm showing now are the corrected numbers, and I've sent the updated slides to Sam, and he'll get them distributed as well. What you'll see is for the taxes that initially are paid by businesses, the big ones are business property taxes, sales and motor vehicle sales taxes, and corporate franchise taxes. Total taxes paid by businesses in 2014 was about $14.5 billion. Taxes on individuals, the individual income tax is the big one, $14 billion. Homeowner and cabin property taxes, $5 billion. State sales and motor vehicle sales tax, $5.7 billion. And you can see the rest of the list going down. That's just for your reference. So determining who ultimately pays the individual taxes is relatively straightforward with the income tax. We get returns from individual households and individuals, so we know to the dollar what their income tax burden is. Individual purchases are a little bit trickier. We don't know exactly what households are buying what types of goods, so we use a consumption tax model that's based on consumer spending surveys to determine or to estimate how the burden of those consumption taxes fall. But it gets really tricky when we talk about the taxes that are initially paid by businesses, because businesses don't ultimately bear the burden of taxes. They pay they pass those taxes along to customers in the form of higher prices, to workers in the form of lower wages, and to the owners of the capital in terms of lower rates of return. So we use a combination of economic theory and data to estimate how those taxes are ultimately distributed. And a lot of business taxes do get exported because a lot of businesses have business beyond the borders of Minnesota. So there's also an export factor that we attempt to estimate, and you can see those export shares on table 2.1. Overall, we estimate that about 15.6% of all state and local taxes in 23 were exported to taxpayers who are not Minnesotans. Our study also is more comprehensive than others in another way, in that we include households that don't file income taxes. It's easy for a Department of Revenue to create a database of filers. It's more difficult to create a database that represents the entire population. We have about 11% of our households are not income tax filers, or 13%, and 11% file neither income taxes nor property tax refunds. So we use other data, including human services data and motor vehicle registration data, to identify households that are not filer households, to try and create a comprehensive database of Minnesota households. From that comprehensive group, we create a large sample, and that's what all the results of the report are based on. And you can see information on how we do that on pages 86 to 91. So the taxes, some taxes we can hard match to individuals, other taxes we have to estimate where the burden falls. So I'll talk a lot about the term decile. So basically what a decile is, it's one-tenth of something. In the context of this report, the deciles is breaking Minnesota's households into 10 groups from the lowest income to the highest income. Decile 1 is the 10% of Minnesota households that have the lowest income. Decile 10 is the 10% of Minnesota households that have the highest income. So each decile has about represents almost 300,000 Minnesota households. The lowest income decile has incomes less than $13,000. The highest income decile has incomes over $201,000. And just as a warning, the definition of household for the purposes of this study and our database is different than the definition of household for census and other administrative data. We consider a household to be a tax filing unit. So if you have three single adults who all file their own taxes, that's three households in our definition. That would be one household in the census data because they all live together. Whereas a family of related people who are all, the children might be at school, but if they're all filing as one unit, that's one household for the purposes of this study. So one of the things we attempt to do is to get information on the broadest measure of income possible, because what we're trying to measure here is how big of a burden are the taxes on a household. And the only way to get an accurate measure of that is to know what their available cash is to pay taxes. So we get information on money income wherever we can get it. We take federal gross income from the tax filings for those people who file, non-taxable Social Security and pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' compensation, cash payments from human services programs like MFIP, Minnesota Family Investment Program, voluntary contributions to deferred compensations. However, there's some important sources of income we do not include. In-kind assistance like food stamps, housing assistance, medical assistance, that sort of thing. Those are very important supports for these households, but they're not resources that are available to pay taxes from because they're an in-kind income. So, and I'll talk about that a little bit more when I talk about the first decile issues. So again, we're trying to get a broad measure of cash income for households. How much cash do they have that's available to pay their tax bills? Okay, I'm going to go over some summary results for 2023. This is mostly in Chapter 2 of the report. So here's your first look at deciles. So again, we broke the population into 10 groupings, and this shows on average for each of those 10 groupings, what is the average percent of cash income that people pay in Minnesota state and local taxes. The big thing that jumps out at you, of course, is the first decile is much higher than all the other deciles, and there's a number of reasons for that that I'll talk about in just a minute. So this chart breaks local taxes in the upper bars, which are green on my screen. I'm not sure if they're printed in black and white. And blue on the bottom are state taxes. You'll also see something called a suits index, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And that's a general measure of how progressive or regressive something is. And I'll give you definitions of that in a minute. But it's basically the people with higher incomes paying a higher percentage of their income in something or a lower percent of their income in something. And same on the reverse on the people with lower income side. So a positive suits index is a progressive tax. A negative suits index is a regressive tax. So the first decile is very high for a number of special reasons. And then you'll see it's actually relatively flat in the other 10 deciles. It's not uniform. It's impossible to have a perfectly uniform proportional tax system. But it is relatively flat. And you'll see that the blue state taxes are progressive. They get higher when you go from left to right. The local green taxes are regressive. They get smaller as you go from left to right. And I'll talk about why that is in a few minutes. So let me give you some cautions about the first decile. The first decile's effective tax rate, that is all taxes paid divided by all cash income, is 36.6%, which is far higher than other deciles. It's also much higher than it was in our last report. But those results should be taken with some caution. Tax burden is kind of overestimated in the first decile for a number of reasons. One reason is that some people in the first decile are temporarily poor. There's 9,000 households with negative income, mostly because of business losses. On average, a negative of $112,000. Now, some of those households may be struggling to meet their financial obligations, but others for whom it's just a business cycle thing, it's a temporary low-income situation that is not necessarily a sign that they're overburdened by the taxes they need to pay. The other really important factor here is those in-kind income that aren't reflected in income. Especially at the lower deciles, you have a lot of people who are receiving in-kind assistance for rents for food that mean they don't have to pay their income for those goods, so they've got more income left over to pay their tax obligation. So if we were able to quantify the value of their in-kind contributions, that would bring their effective tax rates at the lower deciles down significantly. So again, it's an important policy issue, this effective tax rate in the first decile. But it isn't exactly comparable with the rest of the deciles, so take it with a grain of salt.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Ouellette, you referred to the fact that, because this caution about the first deciles in every version of the tax incident study that I've looked at, but you mentioned that the effective tax rate, even with that caution, had in the first decile had gone up a lot. And that kind of stuck out to me. I don't remember what the previous numbers were, but could you just explain that to us a little bit? Maybe give us a sense of how large the magnitude of the change is and why you think it is?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Chair Gomez, excellent question. I meant to comment on that. The effective tax rate for the first decile in the last study, which was tax year 21, was 23.6%. The previous study in 2018 was 28.9%. So there's some volatility in this measure. The big change from 2021 to 2023 had more to do with income than it did with taxes. It was a combination of both. But the big change was in 2021, that was the height of the pandemic. There were very large federal government payments that propped up income for a lot of households, including households in the first decile, as well as higher than typical unemployment payments, a lot of which fell on first decile. So the actual absolute total income in the first decile went down by 33% between 2021 and 2023. So it was more about income going down than taxes going up. Though there were also some policy changes that started taking effect in 2023 that increased consumption taxes on all deciles, but consumption taxes fall very heavily on the first decile. Is that helpful? Thank you for the question. So,
Mr. Watt.
I won't spend a lot, Mr. Chair, I won't spend a lot of time on this. It's in the report. There's a lot of information on what progressive or regressive means, but again, it generally means a proportional system has a suits index of zero. That means on average, everybody pays the same percentage of income in taxes, whether you're high income or low income. So a perfectly proportional tax system, maybe everybody pays 12.2% of their income in state and local taxes. And that would have a suits index of zero because it's perfectly proportional. If people on the lower end of the income are paying a higher percent of their income in taxes than people at the higher income levels, that's a regressive system. The percentages get lower when you go from poor to high, even though the absolute number of dollars paid by higher income people keep going up compared to poor people as a percent of income. If they go down, that makes the system regressive. Minnesota's, our measure of Minnesota's entire state and local tax system is that it's just slightly regressive with a suits index of negative 0.029. That's almost proportional on average. That doesn't mean it's perfectly uniform, but it means that on average, it's pretty proportional. And you can see on the chart, there's a tiny star right next, just to the left of the zero, and that's where Minnesota is. In our last report, we were even a little bit closer to the zero. We fell back just a few hundredths of a percentage points. But that kind of volatility from study to study is not atypical. And I'll show a historic timeline in a little bit so you can get a sense of where we are compared to where we've been in the past. So this chart is a nice visual that shows both the relative size of our various state and local taxes and whether they're progressive or regressive. So the absolute size of the bubbles shows how many dollars are raised by a various tax. Whether it's further to the left means it's more regressive. If it's further to the right, that means it's more progressive. So what you'll see is the income tax is by far the biggest tax, and it's also one of the most progressive because it's on the right side of the zero axis for the suits index. Whereas the sales tax is regressive. It's on the left-hand side, and it's smaller than the income tax because it raises about, maybe 40% of the revenues that the income tax does. And you can see a few of the smaller taxes at the extremes in terms of progressivity and regressivity. Our tobacco and alcohol taxes are very, very regressive. They fall very heavily on our lower-income Minnesotans compared to other taxes, whereas the estate tax and our property tax refunds are very, very progressive. And you'll see those on the further right side of the slide. So again, the estate tax having an exclusion of up to $5 million depending on an estate's situation means most people who don't have high income are not going to be paying the estate tax. So that's what makes that one a very progressive tax. And the property tax refunds are mostly income tested. So they mostly only go to people with lower incomes. So that's also a very progressive tax policy. Those aren't a tax in and of themselves, but we show them separately because they have such a different incidence than the property tax itself.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I couldn't help but ask here. I'm looking at the property tax refunds. And then I'm also looking at the rental property tax. Can you explain that regressivity?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee. So we consider the rental property tax to be a tax on the capital of the people who own the building. And a lot of that is passed on to renters in the forms of higher rents. And given the income distribution of renters, that makes that generally a regressive tax compared to some of our other taxes.
Representative Lee.
Thank you. And then where is the ball for the home property tax? I can't find it.
It is, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, it is the red box. It's overlapping with the sales tax on the left of the axis, but kind of high up.
It looks like it's the corporate tax, but it's not.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure out. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I should add a little arrow pointing. I apologize.
Representative Lee?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one thing that's always puzzled me is that the vehicle registration tax ends up showing as regressive. It is a consumption tax, but its structure is so steeply progressive that I'm surprised that it still ends up on the left side of the line.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, so the structure of the motor vehicle registration tax is based on the value of the car, not the income of the people who are purchasing the car. So people of higher incomes generally buy more expensive cars, but the price doesn't go up as fast as the income difference does between poor people and rich people. So if I'm a very wealthy person and I'm buying a $100,000 car, that's still going to be a smaller percentage of my income than someone who's lower income and buying a $20,000 car. So any time when the ratio between the purchase price and the income gets are at different slopes, then you're going to have a different effect of regressivity or progressivity.
Yeah. Representative Elkins?
Follow up, yeah. So the other aspect of it, though, is that it declines steeply with age as well. So a less wealthy person is much more likely to buy a used car that has a much lower tax at the time they buy it as well. Is that also factored in?
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, so this is one of the few taxes that we actually can do a hard match between what cars people are buying and what their tax filing is. So except for the share of the population that are non-filers, we're pretty confident about the results of this particular tax because we are able to merge the data one-to-one.
Okay, thank you. Elkins. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Ouellette.
Okay, so this chart shows the that same or similar decile burn effective tax rates, but it's by tax type. A couple of cautions with this one. The version of this in the report is missing the decile labels, so we'll eventually publish a different. I think in your handout it should be fine, but in the full report it doesn't have all the labels, so I apologize for that, and we'll get that fixed. So what you'll see here is, so the blue at the bottom is the personal income tax. That's the most progressive of the big taxes. You'll see it's actually negative in the first three deciles because of the refundable credits that people at lower incomes are eligible for. They actually receive money out of filing taxes that exceeds the amount of tax they pay in. But as you go up the income scale, the income tax becomes a bigger and bigger share of the total taxes that are paid by households. So it is our only major tax that is progressive, and it is very, very progressive, both compared to our other taxes and compared to most income taxes in other states. If you compare that to the sales tax, which is the second to the top one, it's green on the color charts, you'll see it has exactly the opposite. Very big burden as a percent of income at lower income levels, getting smaller and smaller as you go up the income level, whereas as a percent of income, our highest income households are paying very little sales tax. In absolute terms, they're paying a lot of sales tax, but as a percent of their income, it's much smaller than for households at the lower end of the income. Now, one of the confusing things about this chart is that because the income tax is negative, the overall total burden is less than the top of the chart for the first three deciles, so that's why I added those dotted lines that show what the net total is for those first three. If you subtract the negative income tax from the top of the chart, that's where the overall net matches the previous chart.
Excuse me, Chair Gomez.
I just wanted to make a comment for committee members. I guess, like, I don't know if everybody knows that when you look at state tax codes, the 50 states, and you rank them, in terms of their progressivity, Minnesota has the most progressive state tax code in the country, which means that as a percentage of income in Minnesota, people overall pay a lower percentage of their taxes. But when, you know, when we look at what, at the overall kind of analysis of our state tax code just in isolation, it's still moderately regressive. So I guess it's just to say, like, that I found that really interesting that, you know, so we talk about, oh, the most progressive state tax code, but we should be talking about the least regressive. And it shows just that we have more work that we could do. We're not even at even between, you know, the richest and poorest among us paying an equal percentage of their taxes. And so, you know, I'm really also, you know, it's important for people to think about when they propose cuts to income taxes, which I think is an appealing thing sometimes to do. If you look at the graph with the balls, it's like income is the biggest source of revenue for our state, and it is the most progressive source of revenue that we have. And when we propose to cut income taxes, we've talked to our counties about what happens. We put more and more costs onto other taxing jurisdictions who do not have an income tax that they can use. And so, you know, so we're responsible for our state tax code and its progressivity, but also have to understand the interactions that exist between our decisions and the local government decisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'm a very visual learner, so this is super helpful, especially the previous slide. But could you make a kind of a assumption looking at the charts between the personal income tax and then the sales tax, which is basically what you're putting back, you know, into the Main Street economy, that the less income you have or the lower decile you are at, you're spending more money in the economy on goods and services than you would be on the higher deciles?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Chair Joachim, so in terms of percent of income, that is an accurate statement. In terms of absolute dollars, if you look at chart table 2.3 or table 2.2, you'll see the total number of dollars in table 2.2.1, the average household dollars by decile. You'll see that the upper income people are paying more absolute dollars, but as a percent of their income, it's less. So yes, the consumption taxes that fall very heavily on the lower deciles, that means they are paying a bigger share of their income on the sales taxes that represent. Now, we don't know about non-taxable purchases and how those are distributed, so that could change. And, you know, most services are tax-free, and generally speaking, people of higher incomes are going to have more services, less goods in their mix of purchases, so that muddies the waters a little bit.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, I will pick up the pace a little bit, given the number of slides I'm through. So this is on page 71. This just shows the impact of refundable credits. Remember how the income tax was negative in absolute terms for the lower three deciles. So this shows the suits index and the dollars involved in the refundable credits and the property tax refunds, which are really the most progressive tools in the tax policy area that you have. The child tax credit and working family credits are $700 million, a suits index of 0.89, which is off the charts compared to a lot of other things that we see. And the homeowner renter refunds are over $1 billion. The renter refund has a higher suits index because it has a tighter income threshold than the homeowner refund does, but still both are very progressive tax policies.
Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I think it was mentioned earlier that the data in this study is from 2023, and I'm just curious if you could maybe also opine. So in 2024, the renter's credit will be we passed a law that in tax year 2024, the renter's credit would be, I guess, refunded to people through their income filing. And so will that change this suits index?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a great question. It won't change the overall suits index, but it does move this policy from the property tax totals to the income tax totals. So I do have a little bit of information on that at the end, because for our 2028 projection year, which is Chapter 3 of the report, we do project forward to 2028 with that change included. But I do have a slide later on that talks specifically about that change.
Representative Lee. Mr. Ouellette.
Okay, this is visually shows how effective tax rates are reduced by the property tax refund. The blue bar above would be what the homeowner property taxes would be without the PTR. The red bar shows how effective tax rates are lowered from the property tax refund, and you'll see that it's a significant reduction at the lower deciles, has very little impact at the higher deciles because most of the property tax refund is income tested. There's a small targeting refund that has no income limit, but for most of the dollars, those are income tested. Okay, I'm gonna really breeze over this, but I just want you to know that there's an alternative way to talk about the distribution of taxes. Rather than dividing the population into 10 equal groups of people, you can do it in 10 equal groups of total income. Those are income deciles as opposed to population deciles. So there is information in Chapter 4 about how income how the distribution changes if you're grouping people by the 10% highest total income, the 10% lowest total income. What this chart shows is the concentration of income. So the first four population deciles, 40% of the lowest income people, combined to have about 10% of the lowest of 10% of the income. Whereas at the top end, the top population decile, top 10% of households, equal the top top 6% of, or the top five deciles. So 50% of the income, or 43% of the income, is in the top 10% of households. So again, this is a different way to look at it. It takes some thinking to get around, so unless there are questions, look at it at your leisure and call me if you have questions. And this next chart just shows how the effective tax rates are different if you use income deciles or population deciles. And the shading shows the same number of people are in the green on the top and the bottom, and the same number of people are in the blue on the right in the top and the bottom. Okay, another source of information, starting on page 82, we break the population not into income ranges, but into household types. So married with children, married couples without children, married seniors, single parents, single non-seniors, and single seniors. And this is really important because what you see on this table is the median income, which is the midway point for these populations, is very different depending on household structure. The middle household with married with children has an income of $150,000. The middle senior single person has an income of $39,000. And what these tables in this part of the report show is how the tax burdens vary by not just by income range, but also by household type. So a lot of information for you to look at, happy to answer questions on that data as well, if you have it. Okay, I'm going to quickly compare our results for 2023 to what you saw 2 years ago for 2021, because there have been some important changes. In summary, I'd say the pandemic impacts that dominated our findings for 2021 were starting to fade by 2023. We had extreme income concentration in the top deciles, mostly because 2021 was a record capital gains year. Capital gains are still high by historical standards, but they've fallen back the last couple of years. And those other income at the lower end that was prevalent in 21, the economic impact payments and the enhanced unemployment insurance payments, those were important income sources in 2021 for the lower deciles that went away in 2023. So in terms of income distribution, the upper decile incomes went down a bit. The lower income deciles went down a bit. The middle income deciles income went up. And that has a lot of impact on how the ultimate burden of taxes falls. Inflation has moderated as well since 2021. So So here's a historical chart showing the income distribution since we started doing the study back in the 90s. The upper bar is the share of total Minnesota personal income in the top 1% of households. The bottom bar is the share of total Minnesota income in the bottom 40% of households. The bottom 40% has been pretty flat. The upper income has oscillated a little bit over time based on economic trends. 2021, which is the third bar from the right and was the main topic of the last study, you'll see the most extreme we've ever seen, concentration in the top 20%, the top 15%, the top 1%. That has moderated somewhat, again, because capital gains income has moderated somewhat, but still the concentration is still higher than it was 20 years ago. These are the income changes from the last report to the current report. Wages grew at a healthy clip. Retirement income grew significantly. Again, we're in a bit of a retirement wave, as well as good stock market years. Both of those prop up retirement income. Business income was relatively flat. Capital gains and investment income retracted by a third, as I mentioned. And then these two significant pandemic era income sources went down, unemployment income and the economic impact payments, which were a good 2 to 3% of total income in 2021 and went away completely after that. And then the tax changes in that same time period. Individual income tax was relatively flat. It's been growing as a trend, but it is a volatile revenue source to some degree, so there's always going to be some up and down. And the way we summarize them for this report, they were relatively flat in that time period. The consumption taxes and property taxes grew a lot more. Some of that was policy changes. A lot of that was just economic changes. People's income growing, they're going to make more taxable purchases. We also had a lot of local taxes that have been enacted between 2021 and 2023. The metro tax, two metro taxes that total 1% of purchase price were partially in effect in 2023. They took effect in October of 2023. So that was starting to show up in 2023. It'll be an even bigger factor in the 2028 projection year. And then this is just the change in effective tax rates between 21 and 23. Again, the very large growth in the first decile, which I already talked about. Generally, growth in the other deciles other than the third decile. One of the big policy changes between 21 and 23 was the child tax credit that was enacted in 2021. That has a very big impact on deciles 2 through 4, but especially decile 3. That's kind of the income range where the child tax credit really hit a big number of people in that decile. So they actually had a reduction in the effective tax rate. And also keep in mind, it's not the same people in each decile from one report to the next. People have economic mobility, so it's different people in each discrete decile in each report, in different households. The overall effective tax rate was high in the 90s. It went down. It had generally been growing since then. It was 11.9 in the 2021 study, grew to 12.2 in the 2023 study. We project it to grow to 12.5. That's mostly due to income growth, spending growth, but there are some policy changes as well, specifically the fully phasing in of the metro sales tax being the biggest policy change between 23 and 28. The suits index was negative 0.023 in 21. It got slightly more aggressive to negative 0.29 in 2023, the most recent report. That's the lowest it's been since 2014. There is some natural up and down with this as incomes change. So as much as tax policy changes that you all make can affect these results, income and economic changes can affect these results even more. And this is a case where there was a lot of policy changes in 2023 that were overall progressive, but the system itself ended up getting a bit more regressive because of income changes, not because of the tax policy changes. I think that's my next slide. I'll get to that in a minute. Oh, I already covered that. I must have gone backwards. Sorry about that. So here's the history of suits indexes that does bounce around, as I say. Some of that's tax policy changes, like the fourth tier that was enacted in 2013. But a lot of it is just changes in the economic mix and the consumption patterns of Minnesota households. So some of this is out of the control of tax policy. Sometimes we're all just along for the ride, despite our best efforts. So the impact of the 2023 legislation. So the tax bill in 2023 had a lot of progressive elements, the child tax credit, the net investment tax on income over $1 million, changing the phase out of standard deduction and itemized deductions. Those are all very progressive changes. Countering that, there were some changes to regressive taxes in the transportation bill and the housing bill, the metro sales tax, indexing the gas tax, and some other tax policy changes. Adding all those together, when we did an analysis after the 23 session, we found that overall those changes added up to making the system more progressive. But again, because of income changes and the changes in consumption patterns, the system did get more regressive. But it would be even more regressive without those tax changes that were enacted in 2023. Okay, I'm making good progress here.
Mr. Ouellette, Chair Gomez did try.
Thank you. I enjoy answering questions as well. This is a tremendously large project. A lot of the team that worked on this project are here today. I know they're very proud of their work. It's something that the department has taken pride in doing for the last 30 years. It's the biggest and most difficult thing that tax research does. So it's a pleasure to present it to you and to answer questions about it.
Mr. Ouellette, just for a second, I mean, the department does a tremendous amount of work on it. Could you introduce some of the folks that have worked on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Over in the corner, we've got Ben, Peta, Sawyer, and Madeline, who are all members of my research team who are here. There are other people back at the office who also spent a tremendous amount of time on the report. And we also appreciate the moral support from Joanna and others in the commissioner's office as we're undertaking this this very large project.
See, and I always thought Commissioner Marquardt did these.
Mr. Chair, this report is one of his favorite things in the world. He tells me he keeps it by his bedside.
Okay, that's too much information. Okay, please continue. And thank you to the members of the Department of Revenue that work on this. This is very important. Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Chapter 3 of the report takes what we built for 2023 and says, well, if there are no more policy changes enacted by the legislature and based on economic changes that the state economist forecasts, what will the tax system look like 5 years ahead, which would be 2028 in this case, 5 years ahead of the base year of 2023. There were some tax policy changes that didn't show up in the 2023 numbers. The change in the cannabis gross receipts tax from 10 to 15%. Corporate research and development credit became partially refundable. The sales tax exemption for electricity for data centers was removed. The fully phasing in of the metro sales taxes that started in 2023 will be fully phased in 2024 and thereafter. And then that renter credit change that Representative Lee mentioned that was enacted in 23 but didn't take effect until 2024. So those are significant tax policy changes, but they pale in comparison to the scope of the 2023 changes. So we build those into our projections. The economic changes from the forecast, actually the November forecast, we can't update this data base on a dime. So this is based on the November forecast, not the most recent forecast, but the two are relatively similar in terms of their long-term projections. So those are what are built into the 28 projections. Overall, over the five-year period, we're projecting about a 20% change in total income, so about 5% a year, a 22% change in tax collections. A lot of that's just because when income and consumption grows, taxes grow, so pretty comparable. So the effective tax rate goes up a little bit because taxes are projected to grow just slightly more than income. And the suits index is virtually unchanged between 23 and 28 under our projections. There's a whole chapter that basically redoes chapter 2 for the projection year. So that's in the full report for you to look at. And there's a question.
Chair Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to Mr. Ouellette, kind of coming back to that last statement, you talked a little bit about kind of the increase in revenues when it comes to some of the sales tax. Because of, you know, we kind of have come now out of an area of high inflation, does that reflect that portion where you have higher costs of goods and services and then, you know, that sort of thing? Because from that battle standpoint and how it reflects on the sales tax number.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. So the total amount of taxes in 28 is based on the November forecast projection of how much sales tax will be collected in 2028. So it's directly tied to what the state economist predicted in the November forecast for each tax. The distribution, we use a consumer survey and business consumption surveys to distribute that amount to various households and businesses, and then it flows through our model to get to the ultimate payer. But yeah, it does reflect the economic changes that are part of the forecast, changes to inflation, changes to consumption.
Chair Swazinski. Okay, Mr. Ouellette.
So this shows the change in the effective tax rate by decile between the projections. Is relatively uniform, slight increases. The first to fourth deciles are where the big change is, but the income tax in the income tax. I want to talk about that specifically because that's counterintuitive. 137% increase in income tax in the first four deciles combined is actually a negative total amount of income tax getting more negative. We project the growth in the child tax credit and the moving of the renter refund from a property tax credit to an income tax form means the first three deciles that are negative income tax now will be even more negative in 2028. So it's a positive percent change, but it's because a negative number is getting more negative. So that's a bit of math frustration. We weren't exactly sure the best way to show that, so I decided I should explain it. Okay, here's that that slide I mentioned about the change of the renter refund. So we went back and forth a little bit about whether it would be better to still count these dollars as a reduction in property taxes or whether we should move them into the income tax. We could show them either way, and we'd be happy to provide alternative results, but in the end, we decided for the 2028 projection year, we would show the renter refund as part of the income tax system because that's how people are receiving the dollars. The dollar amounts that people are eligible for aren't changing much, although the 2023 changes did make that program a little bit more generous than it was in the 2023 base year. But so what this chart is showing is the effective tax rates for both the income tax and the residential property tax. In the first set of columns, that's with the renter PTR still included in the income tax. So that's how it's shown up in the projection year in the report. The second set of columns is what the effective tax rates would be if we'd left the renter refund as a reduction in property taxes. So it's the same totals, but it just where's the value of the renter refund showing up? Is it showing up in the income tax column or is it showing up in the property tax refund column? A couple things I'll mention about this. The renter property tax refund mostly only affects the lower deciles. There's no change in the 6th to 10th deciles from the renter refund because no one in those deciles qualifies for the renter property tax refund because of the income limits. Kind of a complicated set of tables, but we wanted to give you a bridge between how we used to measure the property tax refund and how we're now going to measure it because it's now part of the income tax system. And again, if there's a unanimous vote from everyone in this room and everyone in your counterparts in the Senate to say no, we like it in the property tax, we'll put it back in there in the next study. So, give us feedback. We're open to feedback on how we're showing this. Okay, we've got just a couple more slides. This shows the effective tax rate changes between 23 and 28. Again, the lower deciles are getting more negative, both because the renter refund doesn't change the overall effective tax rates. Getting lower because of income changes and because of our projected growth in the child tax credit and other refundable credits. Okay, I'm going to end with a comparison to other states. This is on pages 77 to 81. So we use a study from a national group called ITEP, the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. This is a report where they're basically taking national data that's available about all states' tax systems and does a very crude measure of progressivity. It's not nearly as detailed as ours because the data isn't available. A couple of significant differences. They have much more limited income and tax data for all the states. They don't have data on senior households that they include for some reason, so this is just about the non-senior population. They don't use deciles or suits indexes, but we were able to estimate a suits index based on the data that they do provide. They break up income into seven groups, but they're not uniform sizes. They have more detail at the top end. There's a lot of detail in the report. But generally speaking, it's a very good broad measure of general progressivity from state to state. If we were to do it, if we had the data to do our study for each state, the results might be a little bit different. But generally, who's more and less progressive state to state, this is a pretty good reflection of it. So this is comparing, so the seven groups that the income is broken into is the lowest 20, second 20, middle 20, upper 20, and then the top 20% broken into 15%, 4%, and the top 1%. What this chart shows is Minnesota, which is the one that goes up from left to right, compared to the three most regressive states, which is Florida, Texas, and Washington. And you can see they go very much from down from left to right. These three states do not have an individual income tax. That's one of the key measures of how regressive or progressive a state tax system is do you tax income or not tax income? If you do tax income, do you have a flat tax or do you have a progressive tax? If you know the answers to those three questions, you can get the states pretty close to the right order for who's most regressive and who's most progressive. Comparing us to our neighbors, Minnesota is the one that's lowest on the left and highest on the right. It's light green when you have a color copy. And our neighbors are not as regressive as the states on the previous chart, but they are more regressive than Minnesota. As Chair Gomez or Representative Lee said, I forget which one, Minnesota does have one of the most progressive state and local tax systems in the country. By this measure in 2024, we were second most progressive. Vermont was a little bit ahead of us, but that does change from year to year who's at the exact order of the states. But generally speaking, because our income tax is so large and so progressive, we have one of the most overall progressive state and local tax systems in the country. And that was my last slide. Happy to answer any other questions.
Okay, any questions from members? Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ouellette, and your team for this great work. That was one of my favorite hearings of the year. So if we could go back to slide 12 about the effective tax rate. You mentioned how, especially in the first decile, it doesn't include the in-kind contributions, and so that's why it's, you know, far out of whack, so to speak. Can you do that calculation? I think that would be super helpful for us to understand that.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, a lot of the data from human service programs, we have to have a special sharing agreement with Human Services and Department of Children, Families, and Learning. We're able to get the cash income. It would be a new process to try and get the individual data for households for those programs. What we could do on a general measure is we could take the totals for those various programs and what the income ranges are to give you sort of a rough estimate of how many dollars of housing support are in the lower two or three or four deciles or that sort of thing. That's probably the most we could do in the short term given the data limitations.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Yes, I would love to see that. And then also, you know, I'd be interested in working with you on other data sharing agreements you need to make a more robust comparison.
Thank you, Chair Robinson. Representative, are you?
Oh, I have one more.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Chair Robbins.
Okay, sorry, I got to flip to the page. On page 31, I found this interesting. You said changes in the income and spending from 21 to 23 made the system more regressive due to income declines in the deciles 1 to 10 and large increases in regressive consumption and property taxes. And that was the year, this body in 2023 did a lot of regressive increase in the sales tax, increase in tab fees, increasing, I believe, other gas tax. You know, there were multiple. I can't remember them all. So you say it would have been more regressive, but for the changes in the 2023 tax bill, where all those regressive changes were. So is that just offsetting by the child care credit? Is that, because it's a stunning statement.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins, yeah, that's correct. The if you think of the three major income tax changes from 2023, the child tax credit, very focused on the lower few deciles, very large new expenditure of several hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't remember, maybe $500 million. Also, the net investment tax on investment over $1 million, pretty much just a 10th decile tax right there, and the speeding up of the phase out of the itemized deductions and the standard deduction, mostly hitting the upper couple of upper few deciles. The income tax, which is our largest tax by far, basically tilted even more. Big refundable credits for the lower deciles, tax increase for the upper deciles. But that in of itself was a very, very progressive change that was larger than the amount of regressivity added by the metro sales tax, the transportation tax increases, which are regressive. But we did a standalone analysis of the total impact of the legislation after the 2023 session, and that analysis showed that on total, when you add all that together, it made the system slightly more progressive. What's happening in this report is that was based on, you know, when we were doing those estimates, it was based on income from earlier years because we didn't have 2023 yet. What we didn't know was the changes in income and consumption in households from 21 to 23, which always have a bigger impact than policy changes. That made the system more regressive. But if we were to model the 2023 changes again on the actual 2023 income, we're pretty confident it would still come out as being on total progressive changes. Does that make sense?
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Yes. So I appreciate that explanation. And I just wondered, though, when you look at, so a lot of those changes that affected the higher deciles that made it more progressive, how did those changes on the consumption tax affect the effective tax rate on the lower end?
Mr. Ouellette.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, they were very significant contributors to the consumption taxes got more regressive. Some of that was because of income and consumption changes. You know, we update our model with newer consumer survey data that says what types of households are buying what types of things, some of which are taxable, some of which are not. But yes, those, if we look just at, you know, the changes to the consumption taxes from 2023, those had a significant regressive impact on the lower deciles. The child tax credit overcame some of that, the two both are impacting people with the lower deciles.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Yes, that's the analysis I'd like to see. So if you've already done that and someone could send that over, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really have to stress that every problem that Chair Robbins has with the 2023 tax issues were part of the 2023 transportation bill, not a part of the 2023 tax bill. Please let the record reflect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Goldman, we will let the record reflect.
Mr. Chair.
Your name was mentioned, wasn't it? Chair Robbins.
Thank you. I just want, maybe my memory is faulty, but I thought we did the sales tax increase for transit and housing in this committee that year.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when other, this happens frequently in a budget year, that other budget areas, omnibus bills, carry tax provisions, usually we, in the tax committee, we usually hear the transportation, education, and in this case, we heard the housing bill in 2023, but they weren't carried in the 2023 tax bill.
You are correct. Thank you, Chair Gomez. Representative Robbins. Okay, let's go to Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you for coming today with your report. It's very informative. My question is we do talk a lot about percentages, and not everybody uses the percentage when they figure out how much they're actually paying. And there was quite an impact with some of the bills, many of the bills that passed in 2023. So are you able to put that into a dollar amount, like individuals, because of what happened, you're paying X amount of dollars more or less?
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair and Representative Harder, in the short term, we can provide some broad information on that. In terms of isolating the 2023 changes on these overall impacts, that's a little bit of work. So if the chair is here, no more bills this session, maybe we could do that. But no.
Not going to happen, right?
Well, we love doing revenue estimates too, Mr. Chair. If we can talk offline, we'll figure out what we can provide you that would be helpful to answer that question. A lot of the difference between the 2023 base year, or between the 2021 study and the 2023 study, in terms of the dollar changes, are because of these. But people are shifting from one decile to another, so you can't draw a straight line there. But we'll see what we can do to try and quantify some of that.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Yes, that would be very helpful, because what I'm hearing now, because some of the bills or whenever that they were enacted, they're now coming, you know, people are paying higher now, so that would be important. So, yes, let's meet offline and talk about that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Harder. We'll go to Lee and then Elkins, and then we're going to wrap this up simply because we have two bills up after this. So, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Department for this very detailed summary of the report. Really appreciate the projections. But one thing that I wanted to ask about, which we hadn't heard, it seems like, you know, the incident study looks at, you know, our legislation and then income and consumption behaviors. You know, for your 25 to 28 projections, I'm curious how tariffs might factor into this behavior going forward.
Mr. Ouellette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a great question. The 28 projections assume that the November 28 forecast was exactly right, which we know it isn't. No forecast is ever exactly right, as hard as we try with them. So any economic changes or any tax policy changes that you might enact before 2028 will change the results compared to what we show in here. Specifically with tariffs, how those flow through economically is pretty complicated. I've had conversations with the state economists team about them. I would probably want to visit with them again before speculating about how they think they might flow through. You first have to make assumptions about how much longevity the tariffs are going to have before you can estimate whether they'll still be impacting our economy in 2028 and in what ways.
Representative Lee. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, of all of the work products that our staff does, I think this is one of the most valuable ones. I read this one, especially the presentation like the one that Mr. Ouellette just gave us, every year avidly. And
it's on your nightstand?
Huh? It's on my e-reader now, but it would be. But the I think one of the things that's, you know, jumping out at this, especially as we look back to 2023, that, you know, with adding municipal sales taxes and ballpark sales taxes and transit sales taxes and housing sales taxes. And right now, the overall sales tax rate in Minneapolis is already 9.025%, at least. And so when we're looking at how we're going to fix the Hennepin County Medical Center, and knowing that the sales tax is just about our most regressive tax, I think that's something that we need to take into account. That you know, if we add yet one more Hennepin County sales tax to help bail out HCMC, or the sales tax rate in most of Hennepin County is going to end up being over 10%. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Okay, with that, thank you very much. And members, please look at page 42. I don't know if this is a good thing for you or not, but you put your phone number there, so we will use it. We will use it. So just take note of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Happy to take questions at any time on this and our other work products. So it's a pleasure to serve you all. Thank you.
And again, thank you to the staff and you, Mr. Ouellet, for putting this together. And if you could take our thanks to Commissioner Marquardt, that would be appreciated. Okay, item next, we're going to go, and I'm going to keep this. Item next, House File 331, Representative Engen. I will move House File 331. There is an A1 amendment. Would you like the A1 amendment? Is that your amendment you'd like to put on before we get going here?
I don't believe that was my amendment, but it sure might be.
Okay.
Is that mine?
Okay. Yes. It's your amendment.
Awesome. Perfect. Then, yes, I would love that to be.
So I'll move House File 331, and it will be to laid over for possible inclusion. I will move the H0331A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 331 as amended. Two-year bill. Sir, first of all, are there any witnesses?
Not that I know of, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay. Does the department wish to testify on this? Not at this time. Okay. Please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've heard often that this is one of the most fun committees. Happy to be here with you today. Wanted to share House File 331, which ultimately is about three things. This is a pro-family bill, this is a pro-affordability bill, and this is a just making it easier for families and students, pro-education bill as well. So we want to deliver money right back into families' pockets, and the easiest way to do so is to eliminate this regressive sales tax on families and students as they go and try to purchase the necessary items that they need to learn. It's pretty simple. I know other states have done it. I tried doing this in the form of a sales tax holiday years ago. But I thought that because of some of the constraints and burdens that would place on not only families knowing what that time period is that they can go and purchase those items, but also our Department of Revenue as well, we thought we would just do it permanently. So that's what's before you today, and I hope that we can deliver that family-focused tax relief with this bill.
Okay, and members, if this looks familiar, or parts of it are familiar from last year, I believe we heard it too.
I believe that was infant care item sales tax exemption.
Okay, very similar, but not the same. So we do, I guess, have some folks that would like to testify. If you could come up and join Mr. Engen or Representative Engen at the table. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Chair Davids, Chair Gomez, members of the committee, my name is Alec Williams, and I'm a researcher for WEMEC Minnesota, a coalition of labor unions and grassroots organizations advocating for a fair tax code that funds the public services that Minnesotans rely on. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective on HF 331, which would exempt school supplies from the sales tax. We oppose this policy because it would offer minimal material benefit to the average family while hindering the state's ability to make strong investments that would benefit all Minnesotans. We appreciate the desire to help families, but feel targeted exemptions like this are not the best way to provide meaningful assistance. Minnesota already exempts significant categories of spending from the sales tax base, which forces our overall tax rate higher in order to raise adequate revenue. Expanding our exemptions even further would move us in the wrong direction. Even among exemptions aimed at lowering the cost of school supplies, HF 331 would be one of the most broadest policies in the country. 16 states offer sales tax holidays for school supplies, but those are not year-round like HF 331, typically lasting between a few days and a week. Additionally, much of the dollar value of these exemptions goes towards clothing, which is already exempt in Minnesota. Furthermore, Minnesota already offers tax relief for school supplies with the income tested K-12 education subtraction and credit, which is targeted at families in need rather than providing a blanket exemption for everyone. This policy would affect all purchases of goods of the goods listed, including sales made to adults well beyond school age. Exempting pens, pencils, folders, and other office supplies is arbitrary and creates a more porous and complicated tax code. Most importantly, the budgetary cost of this bill outweighs its benefits to families. A 2025 survey from Deloitte found that parents in Minneapolis expected to spend $682 per child on back-to-school items, with a majority of that spending going toward tech products and clothing, which, as I mentioned, is already exempt, with no more than $173 spent on the supplies exempted by this bill. Based on that estimate, this bill would save the average family in Minneapolis $11.89 per child at a cost of over $40 million in revenue each year. $11.89 in sales tax is not the reason that families are struggling. It's because of rising costs for things like childcare, health care, and housing, and this bill would weaken the state's ability to make investments to alleviate these burdens or to reduce the sales tax rate overall. One group that this policy might benefit in the short run is teachers who spend hundreds or even thousands of dollars on classroom supplies every year. This might save them 7% on their school supplies, but it doesn't do anything about the 93% of out-of-pocket expenditures that we shouldn't be making them cover in the first place. If the goal is to help teachers with these costs, we could expand the deduction teachers get for out-of-pocket expenses. And policies like this would make these kind of personal sacrifices even more necessary. We believe that our tax policies should prioritize a strong and stable budget capable of funding the investments we need, rather than narrow exemptions that offer minimal relief at a significant cost. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. Any questions for Mr. Williams? Anyone else would like to testify on the bill as amended? Okay, Representative Engen, let's wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, was there? I'm sorry.
Representative Goldman. This is the time for questions.
Okay, time for member questions. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Time for member questions.
Great. Almost. Sorry, Representative Engen.
Chair Gomez.
So, thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So, first, I just want to go to the bill itself. The list of school supplies is on 1.9 to 1.14. It's incredibly broad. It includes basically every office supply that you can imagine. And so how is this, how will you ensure that you're only, allowing the exemption for school supplies instead of inputs to businesses, you know, when I go to the store and buy printer paper or whatever for my campaign, or any other number of ways that just consumption of office supplies listed here would happen?
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. While I don't think that it would be a bad thing if you also received that sales tax elimination, we're looking at lunch boxes, we're looking at tracing paper, we're looking at loose leaf ruled paper, colored pencils. These are things that families buy so that their kids can attend school and have the tools that they need to go and receive that world-class education that Minnesota promises to provide for them that we haven't been fulfilling. And if we're looking at the overall dollar figure, the Department of Revenue provided some of their analysis in detail as to those items and what that cost savings would look like. And based off the items that I've selected, it's $342 of that $687 to $782 annual burden on families for purchasing a child's necessary school supplies. So this is a targeted means of doing so. It's not going to break the bank. We're looking at $40-some million. In the tails, and I think that that is very doable after the $10.5 billion in new taxes that we've imposed on families here in the state in the past 3 years, on top of the $18.5 billion surplus that people don't know where it went, on top of increased property taxes, and on top of that, over $9 billion in fraud. This is very simple. This is a family-focused tax relief policy. This isn't about a handout to a corporation. I don't want that either. I want families to have more money in their pockets, and this might be a simple way of doing so. I know that the testifier invoked the tax credit, but I don't know many families that store receipts in some drawer and then send them into the department hoping that they're going to get their money back. In fact, I believe if I could get a nonpartisan answer to this, I believe it's less than 20% of families that qualify for that tax credit that actually do reclaim that. And so this is a means of putting that money right back into their pocket immediately without hoping that they're going to keep those receipts in some drawer somewhere and have them all perfectly filed up for us.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's not $45 million in the tails. We're looking at the I mean, and the answer to that was there is no way to ensure that this is actually for school supplies and not office supplies. I just want to make that clear. So this means every pen that anybody buys in the state of Minnesota, any pencil, any, you know, envelope is exempt from sales tax. It's a big, you know, narrowing of the sales tax base in Minnesota. And it doesn't cost $45 million in the tails. It costs $93 million in the tails. And that is a significant amount of money. For something that, you know, that is not actually at all targeted to what it says it's targeted to. I'm just going through the revenue analysis detail. So if there's $342 of average spending per child in 2025, you know, if you're in, I think St. Paul's the highest sales tax environment in the state, and it's 9.875%. So then your average savings per kid is $35, which is nothing to turn your nose up at. I think that, you know, people really are experiencing incredible, you know, economic burden in this economy. So it's not to diminish the importance of getting $35 for a family with a kid. But because of the way that this is written, in that $93 million, that it's going to cost in the tails, it's not just the $35 per kid that's included in that cost. It's also, you know, if we don't even need to get into, like, we had fun talking about platinum baby carriages last time you were here when you brought your baby supplies bill. So we don't need to talk about the $1 million pens. We can just, I mean, if you were a fan of the JFK Mont Blanc pen.
Mont Blanc.
Yes. And you wanted to go buy one of those. $1,500 for the, I know you like that burgundy one and the green one. Are they like $1,500?
A piece.
So we can, if you're going those. To buy the Mont Blanc pen in St. Paul, you'd get $148 of tax relief, or, you know. So in this case, somebody who can spend $1,500 on a pen is getting three times as much as a family who's buying the average amount of school supplies for their kid. And that's what's included in that $93 million. And so what we talk about in this committee is an analysis of, because a lot of times people think of, like, tax changes as, oh, this is just $46 million. Like, it's kind of like it's free. It's foregone revenue. It's actually, it's spending. We have to think about it as spending. We have to think about it as, would you want to spend almost $95 million making sure that the person who buys a $1,500 pen or an $800 pencil gets two or three times as much tax relief as the purported target of this policy? Like, is it actually doing what it says it's supposed to do? Is there another way to do it besides a blanket tax exemption? These are the considerations that we have to make. It's how you make decisions about a budget, and it's how you make decisions about a tax code. And so this is, you know, it's just very expansive. It moves us in the wrong direction as far as, we talked about contractions to the sales tax base a lot of times drive up sales tax rates. And so, you know, I mean, this is an expensive, gimmicky solution that doesn't actually solve the problem that it sets out to solve, which is the affordability crisis facing families in Minnesota. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mangan, to the comments.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't know a single person who has a $1,500 pen or a $600 pencil. If you'd like to include that into your exemption.
I'm not the chair, but yes, you do.
If you'd like to include that in your list of non-exempt items, I'd be happy to do so. But I find it incredibly disingenuous that this is not somehow putting money back into the families' pockets.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you. Are we allowed to impugn motives in committee? I know we're not allowed to do it on the floor.
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
This isn't a gimmick either.
I mean, disingenuous is, like, it's not disingenuous, it's numbers that I'm presenting to you. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mangan.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a gimmick bill. Thank you.
Okay. I've got Joachim Lee, then Roach. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to speak after Chair Gomez because you did such a good job. As the Education Finance Chair, we are tasked to funding K through 12 education across the state, and we've tried to dig them out of the hole of 20 years of underinvestment and started to do that in 23 and 24, but we still have a way to go. And what I hear from parents and what I hear from schools is they would like to see more money into our K through 12 education system and on the formula. Just for perspective, $93 million is about 1.25% increase on the formula. It's about $70 million to put 1% on the formula. And that would be huge for our schools. So I would rather see us spend money there as the Education Finance Chair, just food for thought.
Thank you. And I could see working on this as we go down the road, putting some limits on what you could spend on various items. I see the only one is the book bags here. But, yeah, okay. We're going to go to Lee Roach, and then we're going to lay it over. Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I think there's been a lot of discussion already about how expensive this bill is. But also want to refer back to the testifier who suggested, there are already other education credits that we have in statute, which are actually much less expensive. And so, if we really do want to help families who have children in school, we could take $40 million and, make those credits or subtractions much more generous. Right now, the K-12 education subtraction only costs about $14 million a year. And so I think the concern with, the scope of this bill is that we could do so much more with so much less, right? And when Chair Gomez talks about spending, right, we need to make sure that we're a good stewards of taxpayer dollars and also making sure that bills do what they're supposed to do. I just want to share my family collected receipts to make sure that we could claim our K-12 education credit, so someone who does that. And I don't think that's an uncommon thing for Minnesota families to go shopping for school supplies and clothing, before school starts and keep those tax receipts. That's actually something we ask families to do. And that's why, when we look at putting money literally back into families' pockets, Chair Gomez pioneered prepayments for the child tax credit, right? We just heard from Mr. Ouellette in the tax incidence study that the child tax credit was actually one of the most progressive things that we did, and we are also giving money to families, where we're prepaying that because we understand families cannot wait until the end of the year to get their money back. And so these were all ways that we can actually put money back into pockets of mom and dads rather than, having blanket tax exemptions, which narrow our tax base and is not good tax policy. Thank you.
Comments on that?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like nonpartisan, if they could, to let us know what percentage of families eligible for the K-12 tax credit do, in fact, receive those tax credits. Is that something that we could find out?
Who would like that one? I'd say let's follow up on that.
Follow up.
We'll get that, yeah, and we'll make the committee aware of it. Representative Roach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Angad, for bringing this forward. I mean, we just saw a presentation here that talked about the sales tax burden on our lower decile group, which is 22%, the highest of, ratio per their income. And I see here an exemption for sales tax on that exact group. So I guess I don't understand what the holdup is or what the problem would be, because this is directly putting money back into the pockets of people who pay a higher percentage of sales tax. So if we really want to help people, why are we not trying to help people? It sounds as though people believe the government does better with their money than they can do with their money. So I know, I appreciate Angan, I know this has been a battle you've been fighting for a couple years, and appreciate your work on it.
Thank you, Representative Roach. If
you'd like to wrap up, House File 331 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for the discussion. I genuinely do appreciate it. I'm not of the belief that the government needs to profit off of the necessities of children and families when they're going back to school. Is this as targeted as we want it to be? Maybe not. I'd love to sit down and we can work alongside those lines to find something that you'd be amenable to. But this is a pro-family, a very focused form of putting money back into pockets of families. That's what I'm trying to do here. That's what I've been trying to do here. I'm not trying to eliminate taxes on $1,500 pens, which apparently one person buys.
Several of them.
Several. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I'd like to help out families in any way that we can, especially in these times. So thank you very much for hearing my bill.
And thank you very much for presenting your bill. I will move that House File 331 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Engler. Thank you very much. Item next, we will go to House File 916. Mr. Baker, if you could bring your folks up. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Mr. Baker, Representative Baker, Chairman Baker. I will move House File 916. Is that an author's amendment, the A1?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I will move the H0916A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Sure.
Aye. Opposed? I passed it. Okay, the amendment is now on the bill. So the committee passed it, of course.
Thank you.
For the record. Yes. Okay, so if you could please present your bill as amended, and then we'll take testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify? I have two testifiers listed. Anyone else? Would the department like to testify at this time? Not at this time. Okay. Chairman Baker, welcome to the Tax Committee.
And again, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, for allowing us to have this. I know you're at the end of your meeting here, so I appreciate this very much. I introduced this bill at the end of last session. It's an important bill for small business, small communities. And the work that these community banks do in my community is so important. What the amendment does, members, is it really kind of throttles down the size and the scope of what we originally put out at the end of last session. Because again, we initially saw a very, very large fiscal note. And I know that we all care about what is this actually going to cost our state. What this bill does is it just, it's targeted to ensure the Minnesota community banks are able to compete on equal footing and continue serving their local communities. These institutions play such a critical role in our little communities around Minnesota, and this is important for all of us that represent, you know, our communities. Leveling the playing field for community banks is essential to ensure that they continue doing the work and meeting the needs of the community. So House File 918 addresses these concerns. Again, ultimately, it's helping small business. It's helping our small rural communities. We really throttled down sort of the size and the scope of these banks, Mr. Chair. Again, banks that are eligible can't have assets of more than $2 billion. Limits on the loans that they give out, $1 million for a commercial loan or $500,000 for an ag loan. So again, we're not talking about the big banks that you see that we're sometimes are, you know, seeing around the state. Again, I want to make it brief. Again, I've got two very good testifiers today, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have them speak. They helped me craft this bill to get it in the shape I wanted to. So, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, and we'll start with Mr. Rich Jones, President and CEO of Bank in Minnesota. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Gomez, members of the committee, and Representative Baker. My name is Rich Jones. I'm the president and CEO of Bank in Minnesota. Bank in Minnesota advocates on behalf of only community banks across our state. These are locally owned and operated institutions that are focused on serving their communities and supporting small businesses, farmers, and families in every corner of Minnesota. I would also like to add that I'm a former community banker of myself for 12 years, serving at a small community bank in Brainerd for the last 12 years. So I know exactly what these banks do for their communities. I want to take a moment to talk about just how impactful community banks are. These are not just lenders. They are part of the fabric of our communities. Community banks are the only financial institutions with a physical presence in 100% of the counties in Minnesota. And in nearly 30% of rural counties, they are the only physical banking presence. For many Minnesotans, especially in greater Minnesota, community banks are essential. Community banks are leading providers of credit to the backbone of our economy, originating roughly 60% of small business loans, and 70% of agricultural loans in Minnesota. That means when small business is trying to expand or a farmer is planning for the next season, it is most often a community bank that is there to help make that possible. Additionally, Minnesota banks invest heavily in fraud prevention in our communities, from robust anti-money laundering programs to elder fraud prevention to on-the-ground expertise where the banks truly know the borrowers. Minnesota community banks work diligently to maintain the trust placed on us by our customers in the community we serve. That's why House File 916 is so important. This bill is about leveling the playing field so community banks can better compete and continue to serve their customers by reducing barriers and creating efficiencies. House File 916 allows community banks to put more capital to work in their communities, especially for small businesses and farmers who rely on local lending relationships. When we look at policy changes like House File 916, it's important to understand where the benefit goes. Community banks operate on a relationship model, and when costs are reduced or efficiencies are created, those savings are passed directly to borrowers. That translates into better access to credit and more opportunities for small businesses and farmers to grow and succeed. We also saw just how critical community banks are during the Paycheck Protection Program. When small businesses were in crisis, community banks stepped up immediately, working nights and weekends, leveraging local relationships and delivering quick relief. Time and time again, when communities need support, community banks are there. At the end of the day, supporting community banks and House File 916 means supporting small businesses, supporting farmers, and strengthening communities across our state. Thank you, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? Okay, we'll go next to Mr. Jerry Ryder, President and CEO of Granite Bank. Is that like Cold Spring or something?
Correct.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, I drive by there.
Thank you,
all the
Mr.
time.
Chair, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker. I really appreciate the ability to be here and testify on behalf of HF 916. I, like Rich, had a lot of data pulled together to talk about, but he's hit on a lot of it, so I really kind of want to get to the essence of what we're trying to help, what we're trying to achieve here. As it was just mentioned, community banks are in 100% of the counties in the state of Minnesota, and there's 30% of the counties where we are the only physical banking presence in that county. We provide 70% of the ag lending in the state and 60% of the small business lending in the state. But I think what's even more important than that community banks are part of the communities. We aren't chartered and run by companies in New York or Chicago or Sioux Falls. We live in the communities, and that gives us extra motivation to help our neighbors succeed, because we go to church, we go to school, we go to sporting events with all of the same folks that are having the struggles that we do. And we're finding it increasingly challenging to make that all work. Another, I think, key component is that the deposits that we gather in our communities are deployed right back into those communities. And that is no small thing. Rich touched on the PPP program during COVID. Some of you may or may not be aware, but community banks provided nearly 80% of all PPP loans written in the nation. And I think, at least in our case, the reason for that is that a week prior to that, right after the COVID shutdown, we had already assembled meetings with our small business owners, with our farmers, to start coming up with a plan to keep everybody in business, because at the end of the day, community banks succeed when their communities succeed. And I would defy anybody to go to a small community and find a foundation that wasn't chaired or is certainly spurred on by the local community bank, referendums to help the school districts, ballpark renovations. It's all hand in glove with what we're trying to accomplish here. The bill is going to provide a small small modicum of relief, and that's going to make ag lending and small business lending more tenable, I think, for the community banks and hopefully more affordable for our small business owners. At the end of the day, in our opinion, it's a targeted tax exemption, and what it's going to do is drive business growth, and when businesses flourish, our state flourishes. It's going to create jobs. It's going to expand manufacturing. Ultimately, and we've actually seen in a different but similar tax policy from years ago, that the TIF utilization of tax funds. It's a spreading out of the tax liability to induce people to actually invest in projects in small communities, and that is paid back handsomely all across the state. We have a real diverse economy in our state. Our bank is chartered in Cold Spring. We have an office in Spicer. We have a branch in Champlin, so we're in the Northwest Metro. And believe it or not, that's a small community as well. We have, so we feel, and we are a real part of Champlin and Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center, and the list goes on. So anyway, I will stop rambling on, and thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, for that.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Questions for members? Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said that this would make loans, small business loans, loans to small businesses and farms or agriculture more, I can't remember if you said tenable or palatable, but the part that stuck out to me, hopefully more affordable to clients. Is there any, this is a tax deduction for income from commercial loans for banks, not for small business owners or ag. So when it says, when you say hopefully more affordable to clients, is there anything in this bill that would require that the benefits of these public dollars do flow to that, you know, small business or farmer who's actually showing up and applying for the loan rather than the financial institution, who in this case is the taxpayer?
Chairman Baker? Or Mr. Ryder.
Mr. Ryder, maybe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the way the bill is crafted, there would be no tax exemption if the loan was not written to a small business or an ag farmer. So the incentive is going to be for community banks to continue to extend credit to those that need the credit. I don't have any empirical evidence to show this, but there would be a commensurate reduction in the rate, which is also going to allow community banks to compete with those that aren't taxed in the same realm as we are. And as an example, if you take the prime lending rate today at 6.75, a 10% interest reduction on that, or 10% of that, would amount to nearly 0.75% reduction in the interest rate. So,
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any requirement that you pass that savings on in a commensurate to the tax credit that you get to the client? That's my question.
Chair Baker. Thank you. And again, thanks for the question. I think the reason this was brought to us was because I want to have these small community banks be treated as fairly as other institutions that are getting a better deal now, too. Again, they've mentioned being at a more level playing field. Right now, there's lenders out there in communities that have different rules, and so they are able to extend lower rates, have the ability to do that because they don't have the same tax liability. I think what this is just trying to do on a very small scale, Madam Chair, is to just give them that same opportunity so we're not, you know, almost penalizing banks that are not under the same umbrella as others. And I think this is why I brought this to this committee. This is being done in a few other states around the country. That's where this idea came from. And so we're hoping that we can extend those same fairness, I guess, rules in our smallest of community banks.
Thank you. Chair Gomez asked a very good question here. Mr. Williams, is there anything in the bill that says that with this reduction, it does go to the consumer?
Chair Davidson, members, the bill establishes a income tax subtraction. So banks that make loans of $1 million or less with a business purpose, or $500,000 or less with an agricultural purpose, they would be able to deduct or subtract on their state income taxes the amount of income from that loan. But that, there's no requirement that they sort of do anything in particular with those tax savings.
Okay, Chair Gomez.
Thank you. So when you talked about other financial institutions lending at a more preferential rate, I mean, is it because you didn't name the financial institutions, but are you talking about treating an entity that is a for-profit company the same as a nonprofit, like with 501c3 federal tax-exempt status?
Mr. Jones.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. It's a great question, and so historically, credit unions, and I'll just say it, have continued to lend in the bank space, but are continuing to be treated as a credit union with the nonprofit status and the tax-exempt status. Yep, they still continue to do agricultural loans, they do commercial loans, and they do all those loans under the tax-exempt status. What we're asking, we've come for years and asked for the same, for them to be taxed. What we're saying is let's level the playing field from the standpoint of let's make some of these things work. Clearly, community banks do a significantly more amount of loans, 60% on the business side and 70% on the ag side, than any other financial institutions in Minnesota do. So if we're going to be borrowing the money to most of those folks, and we're the ones that are doing most of those loans, we're just asking for a small exemption for those types of loans with those so that we can compete with the tax-exempt folks that are not necessarily continuing to follow their mission.
Chair Gomez.
Okay, so not following their I can't speak to federal tax code or the 501c3 process is obviously not something that is held at the state level. I would assume that if you're saying that these institutions are violating their sort of the federal tax status that they've gotten from the federal government, that might be something, I guess, to take up with the entity that provides that tax-exempt status, the federal government. But I guess I'm sort of moving into a space of treating an entity that is a for-profit the same as an entity that is a nonprofit. You know, again, I don't know the particulars of it, but I would imagine that if you're a for-profit financial institution, there are many other kind of requirements unrelated to this exact thing that kind of gets you that status. And so I guess I'm thinking about what it means, what are the implications if we were to basically provide a subtraction to a for-profit entity to equal the federal tax treatment of a nonprofit entity, and I just have concerns about that, but thank you.
Thank you. Mr. We're going to go to Representative Lee. Representative Baker will wrap it up, and then we'll go to Chair Gomez for tomorrow's program. Okay, so Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I guess this is not less of a question, more of a comment. I think my concern with the bill is just that there isn't a clear definition of what a community bank is. You know, and the Federal Reserve and the FDIC kind of have like a general understanding of what that means. But that's not quite clear here. And so that's why, you know, here this is for commercial banks. And so I think this is where there's concern of like what kind of entities would actually benefit from here. And then I think there's this discussion about parity with credit unions, but commercial banks are chartered differently than credit unions. And you know, that's because credit unions have a mission to reinvest their profits in to their members, right? And so I'm concerned about the argument that because community banks you know, help the communities that they're in, they deserve this, I think it's a subtraction, because commercial banks were also supposed to be reinvesting in the communities anyway because of the Community Reinvestment Act, right? So that's something that commercial banks are legally supposed to do. And so that's where I think I take issue with this. But I don't know if Chair Baker wants to respond to either of those points.
Chair Baker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, quickly, and I think Mr. Ryder has a really quick comment too. Again, I think that what I'm trying to get to is that we've mentioned other institutions, nonprofits and profit. I'm here to kind of say the profit ones should get a deal because I think over the years and many years, the other nonprofits have expanded their scope of who can get an account, who can't. They used to not be able to do commercial loans. They used to not be able to do that. Now they do. And that's fine. I'm not, you know, trying to change something for someone else. But I think what it is as those rules have softened or changed over the years, we just needed then to be fair to those smallest of community banks to why don't we treat them somewhat the same. Again, I mean, I've been in the restaurant industry. You all know that. There's Legions, there's VFWs, and I love them. Some operate different than others. Some have a sign-in sheet where you can't get in unless you're a member, and some do not. Some are open to the public, and they usually pay a little different fee for the liquor license if you have an open-door policy or a closed-door policy. So it's different. This is, I guess, kind of in the same general rule that I wanted to bring this forward to say we ought to recognize the smallest community banks that have a need to be able to compete on some of those levels because the rules have somewhat changed over the years. Mr. Chair, I just maybe Mr. Redder
okay,
can say one more
let's,
thing.
Okay, let's not listen to him because we have to wrap this up. Representative Lee, you got anything else? I've been listening to you, Mr. Redder.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Chair Baker.
It's 12 o'clock. We need to wrap her up.
Yes. I mean, my point is there's no need for Minnesota taxpayers to be paying, you know, banks to do something that they're already required to do under the Community Reinvestment Act. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you. If you'd like to wrap it up, Representative Baker.
No, just really quickly, thank you for the conversation, members. I know we're late on time, but again, my community bank has kept me in business during a flood back in 2016. If they didn't know who I was or had a relationship, it's not the same with different sizes of banks. So this is important, and I hope that we have this possibly considered for future inclusion. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you, Chairman Baker, and thank you to Mr. Jones and Mr. Wright. I didn't mean to cut you off, but, well, no, I did mean to cut you off. Yeah, okay.
Thanks.
Okay, so I will renew my motion at House File 916 as amended, be later for possible inclusion in the Honors Tax Bill, and the Cold Spring Spartans, I think it is, or I don't know if they're having a good year or not. So with that, Chair Gomez.
We have a couple bills to hear tomorrow. We're going to be hearing an overview of the implementation of local homeless prevention aid and a Lee bill that we were trying to get to last week on sales tax for on digital ads and an extension of the sunset for the local homeless prevention aid. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And thank you very much, Chair Gomez. Anything else for the good of the order? Good government all the time. We are adjourned.